A warning for Rocket Man today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump used his UN address to call Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and issue this warning to North Korea.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
Yes, he said that. Plus, special counsel Robert Mueller zeroes in on former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort.
He's blocking all of the escape routes for Manafort.
And when it comes to salmon, choosy people choose wild Alaska salmon.
Consumers that have a sophisticated palate, they look for the best in their particular category, whether it's coffee or wine or beef.
Or salmon. Those stories today on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you here with us. Donald Trump has said some tough things about the United Nations, like that time he tweeted that the UN is just a club for people to have a good time. Well, today, President Trump joined the club with his first speech to the UN General Assembly. He began by praising the UN as an institution, and later he got some applause with this line.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
Some applause there, but the president spent much of his time warning world leaders about the dangerous rogue regimes threatening peace and stability around the globe. The world's Matthew Bell is here with me in the studio. Is it fair to say this was kind of an Axis of Evil 2.0 speech from President Trump?
I think so. It was very reminiscent of 2002 with George W. Bush talking about Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. It was extraordinary how President Trump talked about North Korea. He said, "No one has shown more contempt for other nations and the well-being of their own people than the depraved regime in North Korea." Trump called the North Korean government a band of criminals, and then he had this warning.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do.
Rocket Man, he's referring there, of course, to Kim Jong-un, his new nickname for the North Korean leader, copying the title of Elton John's famous song. Somewhat bizarre, but those other statements are simply extraordinary, Matthew. Did Trump offer any hints about what comes next in the standoff with North Korea?
He seemed to be hinting that he wanted to hear more from the United Nations, that, like we heard there. He also talked about denuclearization as being the focus of his administration's approach toward North Korea. And I think this is a response to what some experts have been saying recently, and that is that maybe it's time for Washington to think about learning to live with a nuclear North Korea. I think Trump was trying to signal that, no, that's not part of the administration's plan. And then, Marco, Trump quickly pivoted to Iran. He said that the nuclear deal that President Obama signed with Iran was an embarrassment. He said it was one of the worst deals. This is something he's repeated again and again. He seemed to be hinting there that maybe the administration's going to walk away from the Iran deal. And here's more of what he had to say.
The Iranian government masks a corrupt dictatorship behind the false guise of a democracy. It has turned a wealthy country with a rich history and culture into an economically depleted rogue state whose chief exports are violence, bloodshed, and chaos. The longest suffering victims of Iran's leaders are, in fact, its own people.
Matthew, what was missing from President Trump's speech today?
The big thing, I think, Marco, was climate change. I mean, this is an issue that the UN Secretary General has brought up, that many of the diplomats in that room have worked on, that the previous U.S. administration worked on. And there have been questions about whether President Trump is serious about walking away from the Paris Climate Agreement. He didn't mention climate change at all today, and that may be taken as a sign that he's serious about walking away from the deal. Another thing that he didn't mention was the situation, the humanitarian disaster in Myanmar, which a lot of people have looked at and said this is just a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, that the Rohingya Muslim minority there is being driven out of villages, thousands of people suffering, fleeing for their lives. This would have been the kind of situation you can imagine a U.S. president would have been delivering the message of putting a stop to this to the U.N. General Assembly. We didn't hear President Trump talk about that today.
So some of the things he didn't bring up, and oddly, he did bring up the case of Venezuela, the crisis down there.
He did, and he said the reason why Venezuela is in such a mess right now is because of socialism. He said because the government took the road, the socialist road, that that's the cause of all of the problems there right now. He said that the people in Venezuela deserve democracy. He didn't say what the United States might do toward that end, but it's interesting that it did get mentioned.
The World's Matthew Bell, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's something else President Trump did not mention at the UN, the ongoing investigation into Russia's meddling in the U.S. election and the alleged links between Moscow and Trump's campaign. This week, we learned that Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, was wiretapped by investigators both before and after the election. A federal judge approved two Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants, or FISA warrants, allowing the wiretaps. Former Special Agent Asha Rangappa conducted counterintelligence investigations for the FBI, and she tells us FISA warrants are not easy to get.
What the FBI has to do is go into a secret FISA court and show the judge that there's probable cause to believe that the person they are targeting is acting as what's called an agent of a foreign power, that they're acting at the direction and control of a foreign intelligence service in this case.
So if all of Manafort's calls were intercepted in these periods, does that mean that somewhere there are hours and hours of recorded audio of Manafort's conversations?
Not necessarily. So the FBI agents themselves aren't sitting there with a headphone all day long. The FBI has people who monitor these. They have people who speak different languages depending on the language of the target. And those monitors are basically transcribing only the communications that they think might have intelligence value. And anything that is not foreign intelligence related, after the agent reviews it, has to basically be discarded. Now, if they come across criminal activity in the course of monitoring communications with the Russians, like he's getting money and, you know, laundering it or whatever, they will have to open a separate criminal case.
There was this gap in the FISA wiretaps, and this gap actually covers the period of the infamous Trump Tower meeting 2 weeks after the election. Listeners will remember this is the meeting where Paul Manafort, along with Trump's eldest son and Jared Kushner and some others, met with a Russian lawyer. Will this be kind of like the metaphoric missing tape in the Nixon White House?
Actually, that's such a great analogy. Maybe that is actually a critical piece that Mueller really wants to get in Manafort's own words. We do know that he did open a criminal investigation on Manafort. We know this because he's conducted a criminal search warrant on Manafort's home. And, you know, he's been putting pressure on Manafort.
And right. And another development in the last 24 hours, we've learned that Robert Mueller's investigators told Manafort he will be indicted. That's also big. What is the significance of that?
They want him to talk. I think that they believe that he holds the key to many unanswered questions that they may have, possibly about that particular gap or that particular meeting. They're going to use the threat of jail to try to get him to talk. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, and got to say, too, that when the FBI agents raided Manafort's home in Virginia in July, they came with a search warrant and they picked the lock, forced entry. He must be starting to feel the heat.
So normally when you execute a search warrant, you show up at the target's house, you knock on the door really loudly at 5 a.m. and say, FBI, open the door. And you have to sit there and wait for 2 to 5 minutes, or you have to give the person a reasonable amount of time to put on their pajamas or robe and come down and open the door. Mm. Now, if you have reason to believe that the target may destroy or conceal evidence that you are looking for, you can get the judge to approve what's called a no-knock warrant, which is what was apparently obtained in this case. That allows you to pick the lock or break down the door or do what you need to do to go in immediately without letting the target know that you're there.
What does all this mean for the future of the Trump-Russia investigation, do you think?
Mueller was the director of the FBI when I was in the FBI, and I don't think he makes idle threats. So I presume that if Manafort doesn't flip or talk or do what they're hoping that he's going to do, that he will be indicted. And the president could pardon Manafort. And the next chess move is that Mueller has been working with the New York Attorney General. And the New York Attorney General can bring charges under state law. Presidential pardons don't reach state crimes. Only the state governors can do that. So I think that the fact that Mueller is working with the New York Attorney General, it's kind of, he's blocking all of the escape routes for Manafort.
Former FBI Special Agent Asha Rangappa, now at the Yale Law School. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
A strong earthquake rocked Mexico City this afternoon. The U.S. Geological Survey says it was a magnitude 7.1 quake with an epicenter in the nearby state of Puebla. There are lots of reports of damage in the Mexican capital, including several building collapses. It so happens that today is the anniversary of the devastating quake that struck Mexico City 32 years ago on September 19th, 1985, which means that earlier today, many Mexico City residents were marking that anniversary by taking part in an earthquake drill. Then, hours later, the real thing. At this point, we can't confirm an exact number of casualties or even the extent of the damage in the city or elsewhere in Mexico. But earlier, I did speak with reporter Manuel Rueda, who is in Mexico City. Manuel, tell me, first of all, what did you feel?
Oh, it felt like you were on a rocking ship in high seas. I was exiting a bank. I was at the sidewalk level, but it still felt very strong. And immediately everyone started to flood out of their buildings. And the people who were coming out of the office buildings were very shaken, very scared.
Yeah, we've now heard reports from the mayor of Mexico City that there are fires, collapsed buildings, people are trapped in some of the buildings. What can you tell us?
I haven't been able to make the rounds of the city yet because traffic is really heavy right now. Lots of the main avenues have been closed and people are still walking around. People can't go into buildings yet. So I'm not sure on these reports of fires, but I have seen pictures on Twitter of buildings that have collapsed in the city, such as a convenience store. There's a rumor that two...
You're still with us, Manuel?
Yes, I am.
Tell me, are there casualties being reported?
I haven't been able to get near a TV yet because everything is closed. So I'm not sure on the casualty number so far.
Yeah, so you say people are still walking around the streets. Sounds like a bit of a daze. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's still the case. I'm talking to you right now. I'm standing outside a shopping mall, so I'm using the Wi-Fi from the shopping mall. But the shopping mall is closed, for example. All the buildings are closed. I did see a barber shop where they were already, tending to their clients once again. So maybe some people are taking it easy, but most the city is at a standstill right now for the most part. Everything is shut down. Even the metro, they said, is also shut down, the subway system.
Emmanuel, how are the emergency services reacting? What have you seen?
Well, there's helicopters flying around the city. That's regular protocol in Mexico City where there are so many earthquakes. They're...
That may do it. No, Manuel's still with us?
Trying to head somewhere. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, Manuel. It sounds very chaotic, and we'll be following the story surely in the days to come. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
And stay safe.
Okay.
That's reporter Manuel Rueda in Mexico City. Up next, Alaska's wild salmon goes global. This is The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The World in Words.
Oh, heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The World in Words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World on your radio. For our 50 States project, we're visiting every state in the nation, looking at how a shrinking global economy is impacting communities all across America. Today, we head to Cordova, Alaska, population 2,205. Like many American small towns, Cordova has lost out to overseas manufacturing. But in this case, we're not talking TVs or cars. We're talking fish, salmon. And the good folks in Cordova, they went from fighting global competition to embracing it to an extent. The world's Jason Margolis has our story.
40 years ago, Alaska had a near monopoly supplying the world with salmon. But then Norwegian fishermen began experimenting with salmon farming, raising fish in enclosed ocean pens. By the 90s, salmon farming had taken off, not just in Norway, but also in Canada, Scotland, and Chile. As global supplies skyrocketed, Alaska salmon prices plummeted.
How much did they fall?
That's Gunnar Knapp, an economist and fisheries expert with the University of Alaska, Anchorage.
In 1988, the price of for sockeye salmon in Alaska was well over $2 a pound. By about 2000, the price had fallen to 40 cents a pound.
That's like going from earning $50,000 a year to $10,000. So why on earth did Mike Mahoney move to Alaska to fish salmon at that very moment?
I didn't really know any better because I came up here from Minnesota and I just thought I'd give it a whirl. It was easier to buy in at that time because it was so depressed.
In Alaska, commercial fishermen have to buy permits. When Mahoney moved to Cordova, the area was still also recovering from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Despite it all, for Mahoney, it was an easy call. He looks around at the harbor and mountains. It's shockingly beautiful.
I love my job. Yeah. It's pretty wonderful what we get to do here. Just being able to have the freedom to move around and to be able to go hunt for the fish. I actually really enjoy that part of it.
Alaskan fishermen spending days at sea, sleeping on small vessels. It's a romantic image. Modern salmon farming? That's a different visual. A guy at a computer monitors the fish with underwater cameras. When it's feeding time, he presses a button, and long tubes deliver food to tens of thousands of fish swimming in enclosed areas, sunken pens often the size of a basketball court. Salmon farming has been criticized for years for overusing antibiotics, harboring diseases, and allowing fish to escape and contaminate or crossbreed with wild stocks. The industry is trying to address the problems, working with environmental NGOs to adopt more stringent standards. I asked Mahoney what he thinks of farm salmon.
I don't know. I mean, I do sort of see them as competition, but I'm not here to trash those guys either. But you could think of these salmon farms as confinement feedlots, and if you wanted to use that analogy.
Mahoney's ambivalence isn't unique around here. I visited Copper River Seafood's production facility. Workers wielding knives rapidly pluck and gut salmon from an assembly line.
So the fillets go down and they'll trim the bellies.
CEO Scott Blake is a fourth-generation fisherman. He says competition from farm salmon nearly crashed the Alaskan market in the 1990s. And yet, he too is ambivalent about all that global competition.
I hate to say this, I think it's helped us.
Why do you say I hate to say this, but it's helped?
There's such a stigmatism in Alaska that farm salmon is the evil. And whether we like it or we don't like it, it's always going to be here. We compete for the center of the plate. We compete against chicken, beef, pork, farm salmon, other protein resources.
Blake and many other Alaska salmon fishermen, they want more people eating salmon. Alaska does use hatcheries, growing and releasing young salmon into the wild to increase stocks. Still, there's just not enough wild Alaska salmon to go around. I stand on a bridge over the Copper River with Krista Hoover as salmon return from the ocean and swim upriver to spawn. Hoover markets salmon for the area's fishermen. She says after people get a taste for the more plentiful and cheaper farm stuff, she wants them to sample Alaskan, what many here bill as the French wine of salmon.
I would say that's a fair analogy, yeah. Consumers that have a sophisticated palate, they look for the best in their particular category, whether it's coffee or wine or beef.
I ask her to describe how Alaska wild salmon is better.
It's richer. It has a deeper, truer salmon flavor. It definitely has a mouthfeel that's different. It's silkier.
This sales pitch seems to be working. The price for Alaskan salmon has rebounded in the past few years. It's also been helped by a drop in worldwide supplies. Sea lice outbreaks on salmon farms in Scotland, Norway, and Canada, and an algal bloom in Chile have depressed worldwide stocks. Taya Thomas has been fishing the waters around Cordova since the 1980s. She was bringing her boat back into the docks during the early evening when we met.
It was not a very good day. I got about 400 pounds.
400 pounds. And what is it selling for? How much a pound?
The sockeye are selling for about, I think they're $275 a pound.
So you made $1,000?
Yeah. It was okay. I made some money. I mean, I paid for fuel and made some money, so.
$1,000 might sound like a lot of cash for a day's work, but that's not all profit. And Thomas can only fish for about 5 months a year, working long hours. She has plenty of downtime, though. She casts her gill net about once an hour and then waits.
So I made, I don't know, I made probably at least 10 sets today or maybe 9 sets.
So what do you do? What do you do when the net is out there and you're just waiting?
Well, I should be reading my book, but today I was listening to an audiobook. So I do that a lot.
When it comes to salmon farming, she wasn't ambivalent. I told her that I'd asked another Cordova fisherman if he'd consider farming salmon.
No. Okay, what did he say?
Well, let me ask you, why don't you just become a salmon farmer? It's so much easier.
Oh, but it's not even comparable. First of all, you know, I am against salmon farms, even though I shouldn't really be saying that. But, I mean, when I see what they're doing to the coastlines, and they're not good for the environment, and I really don't think that the product is that great. Whereas here we are in Alaska.
For Thomas, it's about fishing sustainably, delivering tastier salmon, and ultimately preserving jobs.
You're supporting these wonderful coastal communities in Alaska, which is this, you know, we don't want to see this lifestyle go away.
Nor does the state of Alaska. It's banned finfish farming since 1990. But even Thomas grudgingly concedes there's a place for the farm stuff, as long as it's better controlled. And again, if it gets more people eating salmon, that's good for Alaskan fishermen. For The World, Jason Margolis, Cordova, Alaska.
If you have a story idea about how your town has changed in the era of hyper-globalization, drop us a line. We consider all submissions, and we may even come to visit. Really?
Hello?
Hi, I'm trying to reach Steve, please.
Yeah, this is him.
Hey, I'm just responding to your submission on our 50 States web page.
Just go to pri.org/50states to find out how to be a part of our project.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Aung San Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize, but critics say she's not doing enough to help the Rohingya. This fellow Nobel laureate remembers asking Suu Kyi about human rights in Burma a few years ago.
It was about the Rohingya and how was she going to handle that, and the response was phenomenally hostile.
That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So you think we're the only ones with a leader who loves social media? We're not. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi apparently gives President Trump a run for his money on Twitter. And in addition to that, Modi also has a sometimes uncomfortably close relationship with social media trolls. Swati Chaturvedi is the author of I Am a Troll, in which she explores India's army of right-wing social media trolls, and she joins us from Delhi. So for those people who are not familiar with Prime Minister Modi, how important is social media to him? Does he tweet as frequently as Trump?
He tweets as frequently as Trump. He's obsessed with it. It's kind of replaced, you know, mainstream media. Like, we wake up to Trump tweet storms. In some ways, Narendra Modi is like the father of what Trump is now doing. Narendra Modi doesn't troll himself, but he's got his entire army, which is really like a virtual army, which is ready, you know, and at his bidding to attack any kind of opponents. The difference with Trump is that Mr. Trump is also engaging with, normal media. Mr. Modi has been now prime minister for 3.5 years. He's not even held a single press conference. He loves, one-way dialogue, which he does through Twitter, where, he's followed a lot, and through something called Mann Ki Baat, which is like a monologue radio show that he does.
So an army of trolls. That sounds pretty insidious. You did look into how his party, the BJP, has organized social media support through call centers. That sounds pretty organized, strategic.
Oh, it's completely organized and strategic. There are three nerve centers of this. One is in, Bangalore, where, which all of you will be aware of, are familiar with as the heart of call centers. Two are in Gujarat, which is Mr. Modi's own state. And they virtually act like a 9-to-5, 24/7 call center. But your job is to go out there and spew abuse, spew death threats, tweet communal incitement, put out fake videos. So that's your basically a 9-to-5 daily routine. They've almost institutionalized it. They've made it into like something like business as usual.
And these trolls, do they go looking for people who are critiquing Modi or his party, or are they kind of planting stuff and seeing kind of what sprouts?
Well, it's very interesting. They're very high-tech about it. The minute anybody, Narendra Modi's name is mentioned, they have this like a nerve center in the party's headquarters, so it kind of lights up. And then it's like a swarm of, say, ants which just get in there and just kind of drown out that particular voice. And they don't hold back. There's a rash of death threats, rape threats, communal incitement, you name it, they do it.
Can you give us a case of trolling that got especially nasty?
Well, I'll give you an example of the actor who's a superstar called Aamir Khan. I investigated this in my book. The BJP's then IT chief was actually sending, a WhatsApp forward saying with a draft petition of how, an Indian company called Snapdeal should either boycott him, drop him as a brand ambassador, or they should be boycotted. So you basically had the ruling party and the government attacking an Indian citizen and attacking an Indian company. So it can get extremely nasty.
In some ways, though, couldn't you argue that this kind of freewheeling dialogue is actually democracy in action?
Not when it's, I'm all for free speech. I'm a journalist. Free speech is my bread and butter. But, the point is, you're from the U.S. The U.S. is the freest speech laws in the world. But every day people are arrested when there's an actual actionable threat or there's incitement. This is not freedom of expression. Hate speech is not freedom of expression. Death threats are not freedom of expression. Neither are rape threats. So, recently the one journalist was shot dead. And it turned out that three of the people that Mr. Modi followed actually celebrated her death. And Mr. Modi has recently, on his birthday, started following 50 more people. But he's not even unfollowed one of the single hate handles which he religiously follows.
So how has your book, I Am a Troll, been received in India? What's been the reaction? And do you have any accounts personal to share about this kind of thing?
I've received a huge number of threats. In fact, my family, I joke with them, but they are really quite worried about it because, it's not a very safe situation to be when you've kind of taken on and unmasked the entire troll army of the ruling party. But I guess that's our job. That's what we sign up for. And for a liberal woman journalist in India, a good day is when you get only 100 rape threats. A bad day would be when you wake up like 1,000. It's become really that bad.
Really? Yeah. 1,000 a day?
Yes. Yes.
Swati Chaturvedi is the author of I Am a Troll. Thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As a candidate, Donald Trump got support from a different army of trolls. Thousands of fake accounts reportedly linked to Russian President Vladimir Putin's government. Their goal? To spread fake news and disinformation during the U.S. election. And many observers worried that a similar scenario would play out in Germany ahead of its general election this weekend.
In Germany, we had only very few bots, whereas in the U.S., the role of bots was bigger.
Lisa Maria Neudert there with the Oxford Internet Institute. She's the lead researcher of a study out today looking at how online trolls and fake news are playing out on Twitter ahead of Germany's election.
The content that we have seen is similar to the U.S. elections in that it is also very much playing with fears and skepticism surrounding the political establishment, surrounding issues like immigration, security of workplace. So I think there's a topical overlap. And also interesting would be there are bots that are supportive of Trump, yet very critical of the chancellor we're having right now, Angela Merkel. Indeed, that seems to be one of the topics that we have seen bot accounts tweeting about frequently.
Mm. And these bots that you have tracked, can you trace them to the Kremlin?
No, we cannot. There is evidence that some of the bots might be associated with the Kremlin. That is, for example, bots that are tweeting in Russian and then tweeting again in German. However, that is very few accounts, roughly a number between 90 to 100 accounts.
So when it comes to fake news here in the U.S., we had a huge problem of it being shared quite widely. It's not just an issue of planting it. You need a public to share it. Are Germans retweeting and sharing the fake content you've been tracking?
So we find that in Germany, the amount of disinformation compared to especially the U.S. is rather moderate. In the U.S., we found a ratio of junk news to professional news of 1-to-1, whereas in Germany, it's only around a fifth of news that are being junk and disinformation content.
So just as a point on definitions, how would you differentiate between junk news and professional news? What do you mean by that?
So junk news is our way of what is mostly described as fake news, things that are ideologically extreme, hyperpartisan, conspirational, political news and information. Whereas professional news, that is political news and information by outlets that display the qualities of professional journalism, that do fact-checking and that have credible standards of production.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of analysts were worried that we would see Kremlin-backed disinformation or propaganda campaigns online with the goal of influencing the German election. Were you surprised to find that Russia seemingly has not tried to interfere in German politics, at least not online from what we can see?
To some extent. I think in the spring, the situation was a difficult one. So in Germany, the two major candidates are Angela Merkel and Martin Schulz from the SPD on the opposition. And in the spring, it was looking like it will be a close race, a tight race. But now Angela Merkel is leading by far, and the SPD actually is under 20% in the polls, which is a terrible poll number for them. Which is why I think there is less of a possibility to actually sway the election or have an influence on that.
So in part, it's the Merkel muscle that's keeping these bots from having much of an influence. I wonder, though, if there's also something just in the German character that is more skeptical about, you know, things that come flying over the transom.
I do think that in Germany, especially with the U.S. elections that had seen such a big influence and also where there's been much media reporting, Germany really has tried to educate the public about computational propaganda in the last couple of months. Germany also is one of the first countries to actually regulate the space. And what that means is that if Facebook and if Twitter are hosting fake news, are hosting defamatory content, they, from October on, will be fined up to 50 million euro
wow.
if they fail to take down that content within 24 hours.
Lisa Maria, what's the advice from Germany for us here in the United States in terms of incredulity and skepticism about things that we read online?
I think it's exactly that skepticism that you just mentioned. I think it's really important to stress and to understand that social media is not like any other media, and that with that also propaganda is not like any kind of propaganda that has existed before.
Lisa Maria Neudert with the Computational Propaganda Research Project at the Oxford Internet Institute. She joined us from Berlin. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
After weeks of silence, the de facto leader of Myanmar finally spoke up about the Rohingya. Aung San Suu Kyi acknowledged the violence in the state of Rakhine that's forced more than 400,000 Rohingya people to flee into neighboring Bangladesh.
It is not the intention of the Myanmar government to apportion blame or to abnegate responsibility. We condemn all human rights violations and unlawful violence. We are committed to the restoration of peace, stability, and rule of law throughout the state.
What Suu Kyi didn't do is address accusations that the Burmese military is conducting an ethnic cleansing campaign against the Rohingya. this Muslim minority group in Buddhist-majority Myanmar. Aung San Suu Kyi was awarded the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize, of course. Now many people in the international community, including fellow Nobel laureates, are pressuring her to take action. Jody Williams won the Peace Prize in 1997 for her work with the international campaign to ban landmines. You were among those, Jody Williams, who wrote an open letter to Aung San Suu Kyi recently, urging her to speak up. What is your reaction to her statement?
You know, I have spent quite a bit of time looking at her speech, and the not assigning blame, excuse me, the army has razed, I don't know, dozens of villages, burned them to the ground. They've raped women. They have murdered people. It's the military against civilians. How do you not assign blame? Even the Security Council, which has not done a unanimous resolution on Burma in 9 years, called for action on this crisis.
So tell us why it was important for you and the other members of the Nobel Women's Initiative to urge her to act.
The Nobel Peace Prize, to me, is supposed to represent our best efforts at creating a better humanity. And she, for the years of her confinement, allowed the international community to hold her up as a beacon of democracy and an icon of human rights. I've paid close attention to her actions since she's been released and now as the de facto head of government. And she is not acting like a beacon of hope for democracy in my book, nor is she protecting the human rights of all of the people of Burma, Myanmar. So we felt compelled to speak to her as Nobel sister to Nobel sister.
Is there something perhaps about Aung San Suu Kyi as a person that may suggest we're expecting too much of her? Like, what were your impressions of her when you met her?
She was very straightforward when I first met her in February in 2003 at her house in Rangoon. Very practical. There was talk about being allowed to participate in elections and being the democratic head of the state. But then when we met her again in her first trip to the United States after she was free, she was quite bluntly, overtly hostile.
We had a small meeting.
Oh, yes. As the chairwoman of the Nobel Women's Initiative, I stood up and went to the door to greet her. I extended my hand and said, I'm Jody Williams. I never presume that anyone remembers who I am. And her response was a very harsh, I know who you are.
Wow.
And kind of just walked by me and went and sat at the table. And then I said that we had prepared some questions. It was about, you know, rape of ethnic women in the East and the Rohingya and how is she going to handle that? And the response was phenomenally hostile. She did not want to talk about human rights. She was sick of people always asking her about human rights. And honestly, from there, I was so stunned at how she had greeted me, if you can call it that. And then her just amazing hostility toward questions about human rights that I can't quite remember,
honestly.
We had invited a young woman who had just started working at Nobel Women's Initiative. She was from Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi was her hero. And we asked her if she'd like to sit in on the meeting. And when it ended unpleasantly, the poor young woman just burst into tears and said, I cannot believe that this is Aung San Suu Kyi, the woman I have held up as a hero for so long. I cannot believe she talked like this.
Well, that is an eye-opening anecdote. So Aung San Suu Kyi, kind of a practical politician, I'm just curious to know what you think of the idea that in Myanmar, where we seem to gather that the Rohingya people are largely disliked, what do you think of the argument that Aung San Suu Kyi's hands are tied because of political pressure?
I think it's a choice. Everything in life is a choice. I don't know what kind of democracy she envisions for her country's future. And if you know, we ended our letter to her echoing the words of our dear friend, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, that perhaps the cost of power is too high and maybe it is time to step away from political power and speak out on behalf of all of the people of Burma, Myanmar. Perhaps that is utopian thought. I would do that. I would not be able to keep my mouth shut, period.
Jody Williams received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her work with the international campaign to ban landmines. Jody, thanks very much. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Donald Trump loves the military. Today, while addressing the United Nations, he mentioned a huge increase in the U.S. defense budget.
Our military will soon be the strongest it has ever been.
And just yesterday, he mentioned an idea for celebrating the U.S. Armed Forces, a massive military parade in Washington for the 4th of July, just like the Bastille Day parade he witnessed this past July in Paris. This could happen here, perhaps as soon as next year.
Oh, Marco, the Founding Fathers will be turning in their graves at the very thought of this.
Chris Wolf here, the world's own history guy. Thank you for butting in. What did you mean there?
The Founding Fathers, Marco, hated the idea of a standing army. James Madison, when he was addressing the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, said, quote, "A standing military force with an overgrown executive will not long be safe companions to liberty." In 1776, Sam Adams wrote that standing armies were, quote, "nurseries of vice, dangerous and the grand engine of despotism." To them, the military was a necessary evil, something you held your nose and tolerated, not something to be celebrated.
Yeah, so you've got to defend your country, but how does a military actually threaten liberty?
Well, I think the Chinese revolutionary leader Chairman Mao Zedong summed it up best with the quote that political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Really, what's to stop a military force marching on Washington and telling Congress what to do?
I mean, well, a law could stop them, right? I mean, you're talking treason.
Yes, we are. But there's no coercive power that can physically stop them. And this is what the Founding Fathers had seen throughout Europe in the century before the American Revolution. To quote James Madison again at the Constitutional Convention, "Throughout all Europe," he said, "the armies kept up under the pretext of defending the nation have enslaved the people." They've seen it in England under Oliver Cromwell in the 1650s after the Civil War in England. They've seen Louis XIV, who'd used his army to close parliaments, forcibly raise taxes without representation, and persecuting Protestants. So they were all afraid that George III was planning to do this for them. And that was, you know, a huge contributing factor in their antipathy to the idea of having a standing army. You just couldn't be sure you could control it.
When and how did this change in America? I mean, today we've got a president who wants a big military parade.
Well, it's really surprisingly recently. U.S. has only had a large standing army in peacetime since the 1950s. After World War II, there was a big push to demobilize the armed forces, as a lot of congressmen, again, saw it as a threat to liberty. The draft law had been allowed to lapse in 1947, and North Korea saw this as maybe their time to jump, and they invaded South Korea in 1950. And then came the Vietnam War, which was a public relations disaster for the U.S. military. And it was only after that, in the Reagan years of the 1980s, you get this deliberate PR push to rebrand the military. You could call it the Service, Sacrifice, Honor, Valor brand, for want of a better set of words. That's when the military gets put on this pedestal and assumes the elevated status that we're familiar with today. But let's remember, it wasn't always like this.
The world's own history guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Speaking of the role of the military, we heard this week about the death of a hero of the Cold War. You might not have known about him. His name was Stanislav Petrov. He actually died over the summer at the age of 77. Petrov was sometimes called the man who saved the world, and that was because of an act of bravery that may have prevented a nuclear war. Charles Maines visited with Petrov last year and has this remembrance.
Dial the clock back to 1983, to another low in U.S.-Russian relations. President Ronald Reagan declared the USSR the evil empire.
And the aggressive impulses of an evil empire to simply
the Soviets' downing of a civilian Korean airliner sparked international outrage.
The United States claim a Soviet fighter shot down the Korean Airlines jumbo jet with a missile.
And hardliners in the Kremlin were convinced a U.S. attack was imminent.
Я воспринимаю как доверие к нашей Ленинской коммунистической партии.
It was at this point a 44-year-old colonel named Stanislav Petrov began his assignment at the Serpukhov 15 nuclear monitoring station outside Moscow, feeling lucky as can be.
Honestly, it was beyond my wildest dreams. It was working with the latest technology, working with satellites. And from that system, the fate of the country rested on it. I felt like I was right where I needed to be.
Petrov was in charge of early warning systems in an underground bunker that looked how you might imagine. A big dark room, a giant screen showing satellite images of the globe, green and red lights flashing. Petrov recalled how in monitoring U.S. test launches, he and others developed a certain admiration for their American counterparts on the other side of the globe.
We didn't see them as our enemy. They were like our rivals, like you have in sports.
But like any game, it got tedious the more they played. Petrov says week after week, day in, day out, it was the same routine, 12-hour shifts, staring at the screen, until September 26, 1983, when... The sirens went off. The U.S. had launched the long-feared nuclear strike. Petrov says his crew was jolted, but not panicked. They'd trained for this, and he quickly began checking the computer readings.
Нормально.
The data seemed accurate. Only then the screen showed three, then five nuclear warheads on their way. With every indication showing this was the real thing, Petrov knew he had to inform his superiors quickly if the Soviet leadership were to launch a response. And this is where his story takes an unexpected turn. After five tense minutes, Petrov concluded that something just didn't add up. In the end, he recorded the incident as a system malfunction, which of course it was. The Petrov said his decision was based more on gut feeling than logic.
I told myself, I won't be the cause of World War III. I won't. Simple as that. If they punish me, they punish me. If they imprison me, okay. But something told me that over there, on the other side of the ocean, are people just like me. They probably don't want war.
Petrov was never honored by the Soviets for his role in averting catastrophe, but in the post-Soviet 90s, Petrov's story came to light in the West. He was awarded international peace prizes, though he always rejected the idea he was some sort of pacifist. And until his death, he lived out his life in a spare apartment outside of Moscow, fielding constant calls from journalists asking him to retell the story of that night in September 1983. Petrov would claim he never cared for the spotlight, though he did occasionally enjoy some of the perks of his celebrity. He recounted once being taken down to an American nuclear monitoring station during a trip to the U.S. The lights, the controls, they were all in English, of course, but instantly familiar all the same. Petrov was now in the other team's locker room. But, he said, to him, it felt like home. For The World, Charles Maines, Moscow.
Colonel Petrov's act, a lesson for all of us. And that's The World for this Tuesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.